Hi, friends. Today, I interviewed Todd Waters. Now, Todd Waters is a fashion designer, but when I say fashion designer, you probably think of the runway and Manhattan and Paris and all these sorts of things. That's not what happened here. What happened here is a rock and roll front guy that realized that the only way for him to get pants is to go down to a motorcycle store and buy motorcycle pants, and those were not comfortable on stage in the late 70s and early 80s when he was in punk bands. And so he began on his own, learning from his mother how to work a sewing machine, how to make his own outfits. And so what you're going to hear is a guy who just learned as he went, a guy who took the steps to make his own way through life. And what he's ended up doing is being a main fashion designer for big heavy metal artists and movies. And so what you're going to hear here is a person who just started working on something that they loved doing and making it happen for himself. So enjoy Mindful Mutiny today. Welcome to the Mindful Mutiny Podcast. I'm Jeremy Van Wert, CEO and transformational coach. I help professionals like you dedicate as much time to yourselves as you do to your work by forming a strategic plan for your life, future, and goals. The Mindful Mutiny Podcast is about people who thoughtfully rebel against the status quo and bravely pursue their highest potential. Please don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast and leave a review on wherever you are listening to this. And today on the Mindful Mutiny Podcast, we have a very special guest. We have fashion designer Todd Waters. Todd, welcome to Mindful Mutiny.
Thank you for having me.
Born in Manhattan and raised in Houston, Todd's artistic journey kicked off with childhood, with influences like Ultraman, horror movies, and Star Wars. From the beginning, getting in trouble for doodling at his desk, to his rebellious teenage years in punk rock bands, Todd's creativity knew no bounds. In the year 2000, his move to LA was a turning point for him, experimenting with the aging process of various different fabrics and pattern making. Renowned for his notorious theatrics with Houston punk band Spunk, Todd also carved a niche in the city's music scene. As a visual artist, fabricator, and fashion maven, Todd's innovative work is a testament to the unique vision and enduring impact of Houston's creative landscape. And so, Todd, I'm so glad to have you here and talk about your life.
Yeah, that's awesome. What an intro. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So tell everybody what it is that you're doing right now.
Right now, I'm filling a bunch of orders, but I'm trying to create a new line, looking for movie work and just, you know, kind of trucking along.
And so what is it that you design?
Well, mostly I think I design clothes for rock bands and for people who are like that, kind of like rock minded, but it kind of like bleeds over into Mad Max high fashion, I guess I would kind of describe it.
Okay. Yeah. I've looked at a lot of your fashion designs, and I guess, you know, there's a lot of different influences, and there's some like zombie sort of influence. There's some steampunk. There's some what would be kind of considered, I guess, hairband influence in there as well. And this came from your own history in rock and roll.
Yes, because I never took like design class or went to fashion school or anything like that. So for me, like I spent all that time growing up looking at album covers, you know, when we had the 12 by 12 format, like I would just listen to the record and stare at the people and wonder, you know, where these people came from, where do they get the stuff that they wear, you know, where are they from? And just really was like amazed, you know, because like when I was growing up, you would go to like North Beach Leather or something to try and find leather pants and they all look terrible. So it kind of was like a quest from probably the time I was about 16 or so to find like cool cool guy leather pants. And it kind of led me to start experimenting with, like, you know, tapering my own jeans, taking sleeves off of one jacket and putting it on another jacket, and like kind of really basic stuff like that. It kind of all came from the media I was consuming as a person growing up in the 70s, which was, you know, television and albums and the movies that I would go out to.
So you self-taught. You would take pieces of clothing and you'd make something that you kind of had a vision for as a young person?
Yes. Yes. To the best of my ability, you know, because my mom showed me how to sew patches on my, like, I had a football windbreaker when I was in Little League football or whatever it was called. So I knew a little bit, but yeah, I'm all self-taught and graduated from that kind of stuff to, like, you know, heavy industrial machines and learned the basics of pattern making. And yeah, it's all been self-taught and a lot of trial and error.
And early on, so you were going to school, you were interested in some elements of fashion. You were a lead singer, right?
Yes, I sing in bands.
Yeah. And was that something that you did early on?
Well, I started out as a drummer. So I was playing drums probably from, you know, the early 80s into the late 80s. And I started just thinking about bands, and I couldn't find someone that was kind of singing like the way I thought it should be done, like the kind of punk rock stuff I wanted to see. So luckily, because I was a drummer, I happened to know more drummers. It was easier for me to form like another band and then I could try to sing. So I kind of got into it that way. So, you know, lead singers are usually nutty, you know, and I grew up looking at David Lee Roth and Paul Stanley and then Stiv Bators and Johnny Rotten. And it kind of just smushed all those kinds of things together.
And you had to make your own clothes for this. Did you outfit yourself or did you outfit your entire bands that you would work with?
It was me. And then everyone else just kind of would follow suit because, you know, at that time it was advanced to the point of just sewing patches on stuff and drawing on stuff and kind of switching out sleeves. So we could all kind of do that stuff, you know, and then everyone was kind of doing their art project, you know, their own clothing project.
So yeah, I'm kind of seeing back in the 1980s, there was just a lot of denim, and you're talking about like denim and patches and everything like that. And that's where, just as an example here, the whole like Motley Crue image happens, and the big hairband image sort of stuff comes out, where it almost became more about the image than it was about the quality of the music in a lot of cases.
Right.
In a lot of these bands.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because I, you know, that was the advent of MTV from what I remember. So yeah, it was an endless supply of giant hair bands with their crazy outfits and stuff. So, you know, obviously I was like super influenced by all that stuff as a consumer of music television for, you know, the Buggles. You know, I saw it right when it started. So I was totally bought into that 100%. But one of my favorite guys ever, this guy Stiv Bators, sang in a band called Dead Boys. He had another band called Lords of the New Church. So they were on MTV too. And that was kind of like the more punky version of, you know, kind of like the hair stuff. They were like kind of like a goth rock band. So it was kind of seeing all that stuff, you know, from David Lee Roth to Stiv Bators and everything in between, and looking at, wow, there's these kind of pants, these kind of pants, these kind of pants, these kind of jackets. There is more than denim, you know, because obviously 80s is like spandex and leather and like studs and jewels and fringe and all that nonsense.
Were you the only one in your, I don't know, circle of bands that was making your own clothes?
From what I remember, yes. Yeah.
And I would imagine that you really stood out because of that. There was...
Well, I think, you know, the how would you describe it? it was not for us. It was more about the performance and the jumping around and, you know, cutting myself and rolling around kind of stuff. And not so much the clothes, because the clothes would have kind of been comparable at that time, because I was in the early stages of doing stuff with a lot of other stuff that you would have seen, with just, you know, a lot of patches, you know,
yeah,
leather, you know, denim, spikes, you know, we would paint on the back of our jackets and stuff. I wouldn't say that we were at that time, we weren't like the fashion flowers or, you know, leading the charge of fashion. I think we just had more patches than other people, probably.
So was there a certain point at which you start recognizing that there's a whole path out there for you with fashion and designing rather than the music?
Well, that happened when I moved to Los Angeles by accident, because my friend John was like, needed help driving a moving van. And so I went out there, and then at the time, like, the band Spunk that I sang for had broken up, and the girl I was going out with that had tanked. And I stayed there and, you know, worked some crummy jobs and stuff, and was working at a screen printer. So I started learning about screen printing, and then I'm like, oh, I can do my own images. Like, it took me that long to really, like, even grasp kind of like screen printing. I've been around it, of course, before, because we made band t-shirts, but I was like, oh, I can really do something here. You know, I can make my t-shirts. Like, we talked about, like, the t-shirt is the anchor, I think, of the outfit. So I was like, oh, I want to do t-shirts. So t-shirts quickly just led into me, like, kind of reaching out and seeing, like, what else was going on. And just by accident, a girl that was drumming in a band that I was singing for at the time knew another person who was like a pro, you know, pro fashion designer. And she just put it in simple terms. She's like, if you want to figure out what to do, like, take stuff apart, just start doing that. And so the real big step where it seemed like it was actually a career is when Lenny Kravitz bought a bunch of stuff that was just at her house, because I didn't even have a sewing machine at the time. So she was letting me use her machine. And I was doing these crazy vests out of reconstructed denim pants, and I was over dyeing them. And then I was printing these really big, crazy, like 70s kind of style cobras on the back. And that's what he bought. And it paid my rent for about 3 months. And one day, you know, I was like, I'm in the wrong business. It's like, I should probably keep making clothes.
Did you ever see him wear these things?
No.
Okay. But he liked them enough to wear, to buy them.
Yeah. Well, the stylist bought them. I guess it should be more specific about that. So the thing is, you know, that I learned later on is, stylists will buy piles of clothes, and then the rock star or whoever will just look through them and be like, yes, no, or whatever.
Oh, okay.
So did he actually ever wear them? I'm not really sure. You know, they were bought for Lenny Kravitz. I never saw any pictures of him in any of that stuff.
Still, it's amazing. I mean,
it's amazing.
Quality pieces of clothing that you were making.
Yeah, the paycheck was amazing. And it was just weird because, like you said, like, that was the click, you know. The real click that I was like messing around and then kind of not messing around anymore was like, oh, this actually has like this value, you know, a substantial value that I was not aware of. And that was only because the lady who will not be named, because she doesn't ever like people to talk about her. But I remember the phone call. She was like, yeah, this guy's over here and he's looking at these vests and stuff. And, you know, how much do you want for these vests? And I was like, I don't know, say like 80 each, you know? And she's like, all right, hold on. It's like, they're 500 each. And then pow, sold them all.
Oh my gosh.
Cause she was in the business.
Uh-huh.
She knew what the tolerance was. And she knew that these were handmade from scratch, from nothing to something, you know?
Wow. Yeah. Cause 80 would have been, you know, selling for a loss, actually, you know, for the time that you put in making that sort of stuff.
Right. Because I had no gauge to figure out what my value was, you know, to try to figure out like, oh, is this a 7 $7 an hour thing that I'm doing, or is it more? Like, I don't know, because it's just, you know, my art is just there. So, you know, it's just weird to put a value on it or attempt to.
Well, so this thing happens. I'm sure that there were a couple of different things that happened would make you just go, you know, there's something here. There's something that I can do. There's something unique that I can provide in the world. And how did you start scaling? How did you start really getting up into doing this and putting out more product?
Well, I think once again, she who will not be named made sure, like, because she was like kind of not wanting to do these pop stars anymore. So all of a sudden, I was working for Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears and Pink and JC Chassé and all these people, Tara Reid. And so I think she made me scale. You know, I've thought about it for years and years. And like, I don't know why it took me so long to make the connection. It was just like, when she got sick of somebody, she just gave them all of my information.
And so then all of a sudden you start building a Rolodex, like, of different names and people who know a style that you do. Do they call you and go, hey, we're kind of looking at doing something like this, and then you create it? Or do you just create things, you put it out there, and people buy it?
It was a mix of both, you know, because the early stuff I was doing was so specific, you know, as far as, it looked kind of like a crazy kid made them still. It was like a lot of patchwork, a lot of rough edges, a lot of overdyeing, spray paint, you know, screen printing. Most everything was recycled because I couldn't buy anything. Like, I didn't have money really. So I think that helped a lot, because her style was more refined. It was just like the sweet spot. So if you can kind of remember when Christina Aguilera was dirty, I don't know if you remember that phase. There was a phase where she's wearing a lot of dirty leather and stuff. And so that was the other lady's creations. And I think she helped create kind of like the dirty craze of more worn stuff for these famous people. And what I did was kind of been pushing it a little bit more towards the recycled Mad Max cuckoo person side of things. So it could work with the other stuff that they had, but it was kind of a step over to one side.
Gotcha. And so as you start growing in prominence in LA, do you become somebody that, I mean, you're hiring people, you've got like a factory, or is this all like hand-stitched by you?
It's all hand done. I mean, depending on the project, I've had up to like 7 people in the workshop helping. So it depends on the job. Like, we worked for Black Veil Brides. It's like, we need, you know, 5 guys dressed head to toe in 2 weeks. It's like, there's no way. So you hire in a bunch of people. You know, I've been really lucky to, you know, be able to bring people back and forth, you know, numerous times. So it's not like they don't understand like what we're doing, like as far as the kind of like the aesthetics and everything. But right now, Junker is mostly 2 people. So me, I do designing and sewing. And then there's another guy in LA that does like all the sewing, the rest of the sewing.
You also do movies?
I also do work on movies and television when I can, mostly in Austin.
Okay. And are these, like larger productions or medium productions, or how did you get hooked up with that?
Well, this is another, I consider this an interesting story. So we were making all these like kind of patchy leather jackets. Eventually, you know, kind of what happened was I was at the Rose Bowl, which is a big, you know, it's a big resale, garage sale, yard sale thing in the parking lot over there in Pasadena, California. I found this old 70s wallet. I was like, this is amazing. And it was made out of all rough, like the edges of leather that you never see on any clothing, because who in their right mind is going to do that? It's all the discarded materials, basically. And I was looking at this wallet, and then I also remembered in the 70s, because I've seen them in thrift stores, they have these jackets. I don't know if you have seen these. It's like they took every color of leather that they can and kind of patch them together. It's a thing from the 70s. And I also saw a version that looked like all kinds of different colors of leather, but presented more as like dragon scale shapes. And so from there, that's where I learned about like this, I just call it collage. So a lot of people have, you know, very specific type patterns. I mostly use block patterns and then kind of create within like that space, you know, collaging a bunch of, you know, doodads and whatnots and all that stuff together. So actually, I don't even remember what the question was now.
Oh, it was about getting into the movies.
Robert Rodriguez, the film director, saw those jackets that he really, really loved, all the patchworky ones. And he started buying a bunch of stuff, but I couldn't get in contact with them because the shopkeeper was, you know, they do this a lot. You know, they want to keep their clients. They don't want you to have the information. Okay. We eventually found out it was Robert Rodriguez. And at the time I had a business partner way back when, and she happened to know the makeup artist that was working on, I think it was Sin City at the time, or one of his films. And she's like, well, I can call my makeup artist friend. Called the makeup artist friend. The makeup artist friend happened to be doing Jessica Alba's makeup. They're like, hey, Junker's trying to get in touch with Robert. She's like, hold on. Hey, Robert, can I give these guys your email and phone number? And he's like, yeah, of course. Oh, Junker. Yeah, the guys that make my jacket. Sure. And so that's it. So I mostly work on Robert Rodriguez movies. Like that's, I've been really, really, really lucky. So I just stepped into doing, you know, Sin City 2, Machete 2. I acted and worked on costumes in Alita Battle Angel. We just did We Could Be Heroes, like a kid's film that was on Netflix. And then I worked on Fear of the Walking Dead for a few seasons as well. They filmed that in Austin.
Amazing. And when did you really start to realize that you were going to be able to make this your main profession, that this is going to be something that you are going to be able to completely, not only self-support, but be very successful at?
You know, it's hard to say exactly, because you kind of expect the train to run off the track like any day. You know, when you're like a small business owner, you know, we'd be eating sushi every day to not, you know, buying ramen, you know, from the grocery store. Yeah. So when I describe it to people, I just try to describe it as just picture yourself sprinting, you know, you're sprinting and you just don't have any idea what's going on. So one of the main things that kind of cemented at least like an achievement in my mind where I was like, this is something that's very real, was eventually I was working for Motley Crue. And that was a huge dream because we would all look at the Shout at the Devil album cover. That's when we all graduated from Kiss to Motley Crue. We're like, Kiss is dumb. And now these guys are it with all the leather and everything. And I was working with them and I had a discussion with Vince Neil to say, can I just, let me put a pentagram on something, you know, like the album, you know, Shout at the Devil. It's like, please let me do that. He's like, I don't really like it, but why don't we, if we do that and we'll put F off, you know, around it, kind of like in tattoo style, you know, kind of banners. I was like, yeah. And so when we went to Anaheim and actually saw that on the Jumbotron, you know, I was like, this is now, it really clicked that it's out into the world because I was surrounded by my fellow humans, you know, tons of them. I was like, wow. Yeah, that was like the moment where I was like, this is something. You know,
that's amazing. That's amazing. So back when I was a kid, I asked my dad at a flea market if I could have $5 because there was a classical music album that I wanted to buy, a little cassette tape over here. It wasn't classical music, it was Motley Crue, but I wanted my dad to think that I was buying something classical. So I went and I bought
Right.
this non-refundable Motley Crue cassette tape. It was my first rock tape. And so I got really, really into Motley Crue. I was still in like grammar school. And
Wow.
so it was my first foray into, I guess big boy music, I guess, as a
Yes.
grammar
Yeah.
school.
I remember because I bought Kiss Destroyer at a garage sale from a guy like that lived a few blocks away. And I always remember the album because it smelled really minty and weird, and it's because he dipped all the time. And somehow that smell was on all those records. They all smelled like minty. So forever I'll have this weird connection to like kind of a cardboard minty Kiss record, you know. And that was my first kind of, like you said, big boy purchase, because my parents were like buying me the Bee Gees and stuff, you
That
know.
was it. I
Yeah,
had like
they didn't
five
get it,
Beach
man.
Boys albums,
Yeah.
and I was
Yeah.
just listening to Fun, Fun, Fun and I Get Around and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden I'm listening to Girls, Girls, Girls and Shout
Right.
at the Devil and Smoking in the Boys' Room. My mother would give it to me for 20 minutes. I could listen to it for 20 minutes a day, and then she would put it on top of the refrigerator because she didn't want too much of that Satan music,
Oh yeah.
infecting my young little mind.
That's hilarious.
And so when did you start working? Like, what year was it that you did around that you started working with Crew?
Oh man, that's a hard one. I'm writing a book actually about it, and it's funny because my memory is so bad that I'm not even sure the dates, but so I think the first time we started working for Crew, it's kind of hard to remember, but we were living in the crazy crack hotel. It was also supposed to be like an artist community. It was sold to us as that, and that's a whole other bunch of stories. I'm writing a book about it right now, but I think it's yeah, 2006 or 2007. The Carnival of Sins, I think, was the part two. I think they did the tour kind of in two parts. And the story I remember well because we got a FedEx package because we were supposed to measure Vince Neil's pants to make a pattern. And these pants came off of tour, straight off of tour. And I didn't know that Vince Neil, kind of like me when I was singing in bands, like once you start going on a tour and doing your thing, you don't want to wash the magic out of your pants. So they're not washed. So I don't know how old they were, but it was unbelievable. It was very, very stinky. And then awesome, because I was like, this is Vince Neil's pants. Like he's touring in these pants. I'm measuring these pants. Like it was like really weird. Really, really surreal.
Yeah, and you're living in this hotel, and this is in LA.
Yeah, this was on Hollywood and Western. Like there's an HEB kind of on one side, and then on the opposite side is this hotel. And it was supposed to be like an artist community, but there's like blood splattered on the wall in the hallway that, this guy who was a self-proclaimed pimp, told me the story. He's like, don't touch it. It's tainted blood. And it was a wild place. But we also, in that same place, was a guy named Gidget Gein, was like the first bass player for Marilyn Manson. And I think his name's Rich, not Richard Hill, just some other weird like movie director guys and prostitutes. And it was wild, man. It was wild.
And you're making these high-end clothes out of a hotel room, like to order.
Yes. Yes. At the same time we're doing like the kind of Motley Crue stuff, we're also like screen printing shirts on a table. Like I didn't have a screen printing press. Like normally a screen printing press is like you kind of have like a octopus kind of a thing, and You put the screens in there and you have a flat piece of wood that you print on. So we didn't have any of that. So I just had these screens. I would put it down. You know, we'd hold it down. We'd print the shirt on the table. And that's how we were screen printing, like a line, you know, a fashion line of t-shirts on this table. I think I still have the top of it still.
Wow. Wow. And you were doing just Motley Crue at that point, or were there other bands that you were also doing?
Pretty hard to remember. But, you know, jobs are always coming and going. So I think maybe at that time we could have been doing some stuff for Alice Cooper, maybe around that time as well.
All right. So throughout your career doing this, what has been the role of fear of failure? Have you had times where you have been like, where you've questioned yourself, where it's been really difficult, where you didn't know if it was worth it or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like lots and lots and lots of times, actually, because I'm already prone to that. I'm already prone to like stifling unknown fears, you know, where I'm just like not having a great time trying to move forward on stuff. So I remember specifically, it was probably like 3 or 4 years ago, I was working on Fear of the Walking Dead, like way too many hours and trying to do junker stuff kind of. And every day while I was waking up at like 5, I think, in the morning. And then I would be, you know, taking my morning pee and just thinking to myself, it's like, dude, your best days are over. Your best days are over. And I was just stuck in this bad loop of that stuff. But I mean, versions of that have happened over and over again. Like just recently, like I was like, man, really having a rough time, because everyone was expecting 2024 to be a blowout, and you know, we're back, you know, especially in the movie business, you know, after there was a long strike. It's like nothing's happened, you know, and all my people that I know, my regular customers, everyone is like broke. So it's been rough, and that right now it's just starting to pick up a little bit.
What has been some sort of guiding light or some sort of principle or something? What has kept you going even through the difficult times when you questioned yourself?
I'm not sure where it came from, but it's just, I can't give up on stuff for some reason. And it's not like I do believe in like a spiritual kind of like presence and all that I do rely on. But, you know, when you're doing this stuff, like logically, it doesn't even make sense. Like you should just be like, okay, this is really hard. Go work at HEV, which I may do, you know, or go do this. And usually when I'm starting all those steps to be like, okay, let me fill out this HEB application. And then I downloaded DoorDash and everything. Then all of a sudden these orders come in. So I know, and it's gotten better over the years, that these are these waves, you know, and I don't think that someone's testing me like me, but it just seems like it happens. So I have to manage my crazy, you know, to remember like this isn't permanent, man. Like nothing's permanent. The one thing that's been helping a lot lately is I see a therapist. And she's super cool. And the thing I've been thinking about a lot is she had a set of what she called Native American tarot cards. I've never seen them before. I don't really know what they are. She's like, pick a card. You know, I picked a card and I got the goat. And the goat is never gives up. The goat goes up over rocks and, you know, goes up and down and up and down. I got the goat. So I can tell myself now, I'm like, you're the goat. Remember, it's hard, but you're the goat. And because what else am I going to do at this point?
Well, in you telling your story, the goat seems really appropriate, because you've been in a lot of places. You make success everywhere you go, no matter where it is. You know, you're I'm sure that you've been in really beautiful places at times and in really ugly places in times, and you just keep muscling on.
Right. And I think, you know, part of it too is when I was growing up, like the socializing between my friends and I revolved a lot around drawing and stuff, like, you know, crafts, doing something, you know, being somehow creative, you know. And then as I got into like building models and stuff, like, you know, my dad was I would describe him as a vicious Irish Catholic alcoholic. And, you know, that was definitely a skill for me, just to stay in my room out of the way and work on art stuff. You know, it's like almost you need to be there for survival. You don't want to be out in the house, you know, where he is, because no telling. So, yeah, keeping your head down and just doing the art stuff helps.
How do you come up with big ideas for what you're going to do for an outfit? How do you come up with your plans?
Well, I think it works a couple different ways. Sometimes people leave it up to me to come up with the plan, which is fine. I would say, you know, just based on all that stuff that happened when I was growing up, you know, the Kiss, you know, into punk, watching a lot of sci-fi, being into Mad Max, you know, people have given me a lot of trust, you know. So where do the ideas come from? I have no idea. You know, it's just an amalgamation of all that stuff. But also, I believe there's a guy named Terrence McKenna who's really big into mushrooms and, you know, stuff like that. And the thing that he says that I really truly believe in, and it doesn't have to do necessarily with the psychedelics part, but because the brain, like, no one knows where the consciousness is in the brain. There's not like a thing in there somewhere. So they think, you know, I watched one of my pets die, and you can see the lights go out in your eyes. Something happens, you know, and it happens like pretty fast. So I believe, you know, the consciousness is kind of like this, maybe decides to be contained within your brain, and it's kind of like a magical something. And Terrence McKenna part is when he believes that your head, you could maybe compare your brain to like a television with an antenna. And so we don't know where this stuff comes from, but somehow your brain antenna, your pineal gland, whatever it is, picks up on these, like, kind of maybe, I don't know, these gifts or universal ideas that just fly in and out of your head. The other thing that I think about too is David Lynch even says the same thing. He's like, he was talking about ideas. He said, like, you know, I've had thousands of million-dollar ideas, thousands and thousands of them. He's like, the problem is I didn't write it down. So he was alluding to the fact that these are kind of like either gifts or borrowed ideas that kind of just go through our consciousness. And it's like, we can either, it's like we don't, it's not really ours, right? So that's why he says, like, if you don't write it down, you're not going to remember it. It's kind of like just passing through, like a train through your head or something. But, and this is about a book called The War of Art. That author, I can't remember his name, you know, he believed that a lot of time you're just trying to get, like, he calls it resistance, like the daily stuff out of your way, so you can get in this kind of quiet space. And then as long as you're kind of working and noodling around, like, the ideas kind of present themselves. So, for instance, you know, good ideas come in the shower, while you're driving, while you're working. Good ideas for me usually don't come when I'm sitting there trying to think about good ideas. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird. Yeah. I mean, you just have to like trust that it's going to happen. But also if the artist has an idea, that really helps. So Vince, I think the best costumes, or the ones I'm most proud of, was they did a Las Vegas residency And those costumes just turned out really dynamite. I thought, like, I was really proud of those. And that's because I was like, hey, Vince, you know, I mean, what are you thinking? And he's like, I don't know. He's like, what about Rock and Roll Liberace? I'm like, that was it. I was like, okay. And so I tried to just push that as far as I could. And he seemed to like everything. And I think one outfit he couldn't wear because they're worried it was going to catch on fire, because it was all these ostrich feathers, like in these long, like kind of tailpiece ostrich feathers hanging everywhere.
You know, so I watched that wonderful movie Elvis just a couple of nights ago. And it's a newer one. It's a kind of a artistic biopic of his life. And, you know, it shows him earlier on, and he's got like a gold blazer on. But later in his career, he's the one who popularized that whole rhinestone jumpsuit thing.
Right.
That nobody else was wearing anything that looked like that. It's so distinctively Elvis.
Right.
He made a whole thing that had never been worn before. And as I look at what came after him, there's so many elements of that Elvis look that it's inspired by him, so many things. And I some of the early Elvis stuff, I was looking at that and I was going, David Gahan of Depeche Mode wears stuff like that stuff sometimes. And Elvis's sense of fashion, Elvis seemed like the kind of guy that he would have an idea and then he would just tell somebody, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, and you're going to do this. And then he'd probably make different things and he would select them because it was probably in his own head. And Elvis being one of the kind of fashion inspirations that there is for what the next generation of rock and roll became. What do you think, you know, you mentioned Kiss, are other inspirations that there were for the way that fashion became so important in the 70s, 80s?
That's a good question. I just know the people that really affected me. I don't know how much they affected fashion overall, but Steven Tyler is cuckoo. And that's like a whole thing. That's like, you know, there's Steven Tyler and there's Stevie Nicks. They kind of like share this weird thing with all the scarves and all the flowy stuff. And when I was working for Steven, it's always about really tight stuff and then a lot of really flowy stuff, you know, mixed together. So I don't know if that influenced fashion. I mean, the guys that I looked at and I was just like, what's going on? It's like, you know, David Lee Roth would have some really insane stuff. Of course, Elton John. Like, but that's kind of like from the Rhinestone family, Vegas Showgirl, and then kind of moving forward into whatever. But it seems like he's definitely one of those people that would just be like, I want to look like a crazy sailor, you know, or whatever, you know, and just come up with really crazy ideas. But I don't know. It's a good question. Like, I'm not really that in tune with fashion. I just know all the stuff that I liked growing up. When I saw it, I was like blown away, you know, by... Well, Steven Tyler didn't look like anybody that I'd ever seen. Not really.
So fashion as a concept, fashion in, you know, the genre that you work in, fashion being the means of expressing something. So for you, what is fashion really for? What is it in you? And what is it that you are trying to help express to the world with the things that you make?
Well, I kind of look at it maybe in a simplistic form. It's like I'm in the service industry now, because I haven't actually made anything for myself in a really long time, which is something I want to do here pretty soon again, to see like what that's going to be like. But for me, because of the types of people I work with, you know, the function for me is to make sure that the client is happy and that they're presenting what they want to present.
Yeah.
And then for the clients that let me do whatever I want to do, I mean, selfishly, it's more of an art project. And then what happens when it's done is kind of like beyond me. And I think you know, Rick Rubin has some really good quotes that about that kind of stuff, which I mean, I'm paraphrasing probably, you know, probably off the mark a little bit, but basically it's kind of like, you know, he said two things. One is I work for my, I don't work for the audience. And in some ways I don't work for the client. I work for the client, but it has to feel good for me. There's been times that I did stuff that didn't feel like it was kind of like the art I wanted to make. And it never hit right. Not even with the client, you know? So sometimes like not following directions is a good idea. And then the other thing that he was saying is like, you know, once it's done, like you've done it, you know, and then it kind of just goes to live its own life and I have no attachment to it. So, I mean, you hopefully then what I would hope that my art functions in the world of fashion, just as something that would give people like kind of an intense feeling of that they're seeing art and not, maybe not clothes and maybe not even fashion. Maybe it's something different, I guess.
What's it like for you to see people wearing your clothes?
I think with a lot of people that make stuff, like you may see the stuff that you didn't like about the thing that you did that you would have done differently. I do really like that they're happy. So I feel like a lot of joy when they're like, hey man, check it out. I'm wearing your t-shirt or look, you know, and actually like a few people, two people I know for sure have been buried in their Junker stuff.
Amazing.
Yeah. One guy, Willie, that was from Houston, this guitar player that I knew. It was his request, you know, be buried in his Junker leather jacket. So I'm like, wow, that's, I guess if I had to pick one thing, you know, fashion should function in a way, hopefully, that someone loves it that much to do that with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, how do people see your things? How do they get in touch with you?
I think the best thing to do is go to Instagram. I feel like Instagram is probably the most like lively and up-to-date place to go. That's like at, I believe it's Junker Designs, I believe. And then there's a website, same thing, junkerdesigns.com. But I mean, I would go to Instagram. I think Instagram's more fun, probably.
Yeah, you've got a lot of stuff on your Instagram. And we will have the description, in the description of this podcast, we'll have the links so that you can go and see all of Todd's stuff that he's got on Instagram. The website is really nice. So you got a lot of really cool stuff there too.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So thank you for telling your story and talking about what you do.
And, yeah, no problem. And
all of that. I really enjoyed chatting with you.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you for having me.
Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Mindful Mutiny podcast and go be something great.